lot in the neighborhood, and it would be perfect for a family, for example. But now there's going to be a skinny house 10 feet from a nice house and 10 feet from another house. And it's being built for profit, period. There's no other incentive to put something like that in an established neighborhood that doesn't fit. It just go in there. The developer, in this case it's a realtor, is not going to live there. They're going to flip the other house, and they're going to go and do something else elsewhere. So that's why it's very evident that that particular type of development in our neighborhood is for profit.
Yeah, but I'm
that's great. It's America. We can do that. But it is totally inappropriate in the setting that I was discussing.
But do you mean, I'm asking sort of a broader question, do you think that we as a society should be outlawing a wide variety of things that are arguably detrimental to society and are done just for profit?
If it's detrimental to society, yes. I think everybody here said that there's an issue that is facing the city in our state, in our neighborhoods, our environment, and it is getting out of hand because it is being done for profit. These people are not coming in here and saying, I'm going to build this skinny house and I'm going to live and be your neighbor. We are asking you, the city council, to address this in a very serious manner. So, no, I'm not saying you don't do this for profit. I work for a living. It's for profit. We do buildings for profit. Everybody does that. But you have to do the appropriate things. You have a lot of codes and overlays in the city where you control what can be done. And that's all we're asking is let's get a little more control into these neighborhoods so that people just can't come in and destroy them. If I'm going to put a building in across the street in the park, you're not going to let me do that. If I say I'm doing it for profit, no, you're going to make me jump through every single hoop in the book, plus some, before that could ever happen. It would never happen. So we're asking, why is this allowed to be happening in various neighborhoods? That's all. Very simple question. It has a very simple answer. It can be done. We can change the regulations. We can change attitudes of people. We can provide incentives for them not to do it financially. So anyway, I think I'm way over somebody else's time.
But just so you know, Commissioner, the Bureau of Development Services, we make everybody jump through all the hoops. We don't make any exception for nonprofits either. I had a question for Mary Helen, and that is regarding what Jeff Fish, the chairman of the Development Review Advisory Committee, was expecting in terms of the length of process that you're currently engaged in. Do you agree that you could get us a recommendation for changes in Title 24 by the new year?
I certainly hope so. It is our goal because it's evident that it's ignited a lot of people and the room's full. And I think it's important. And we've put a lot of effort into it. And like he said, it's the first time that many of the DRAC members have all been engaged. And they're from a variety of some people have portrayed the committee as a committee of developers. And it's not. There's land use attorneys. There's all sorts of things, myself and Claire, the neighborhood representatives. So there's an urgency. We understand that there are bad things going on. The builders know that, but they're working according to code, and everybody agrees that there's problems with the code, and that's what we're trying to do. And it also is going to make staff's lives easier so that they are able to have a process that's more consistent and understandable, and won't be so complicated. And the part that he didn't say is he's going off the committee in December, and then the vice chair historically becomes the chair. So I certainly want to get it done so that it's off, I can start something new in January.
Okay.
Thank you. The comment that I've seen, too, that DRAC is all developers amuses me because that was one of my more famous skirmishes with Commissioner Leonard when I was a neighborhood land use chair, was to make sure that it was a balanced committee of a bunch of various different interests.
Well, and realistically, I can see where that was because there wasn't that real relationship. And I know I'm in a public place, but as Jeff said, I brought he and Robert McCullough, who was Adam, an outspoken individual, to lunch to sit down. And I, quite frankly, didn't know if it was going to be a food fight or a kumbaya moment. So it fortunately turned into a really good thing, and there's a lot of good conversations going on. So I think that we've made progress, and that needs to be acknowledged that it's working and that the city has been assisting us as well as your office, too. So,
Thank you very much.
Also, I had one question. How much did Commissioner Saltzman and Fish pay you to be here today?
We're going to be checking into it. Well, we know Commissioner Fish is on excused vacation. Thank you very much, Mary Helen, for all your work on this.
Yes. Okay, next. are Rena Jones, Sarah Hobbs, and Veronica Schindrig. And they will be followed by Justin Wood, Claire Carter, and Rick Michelson.
Welcome. Ms. Jones, you want to start?
Sure. There's quite a few things. So I wanted to actually go back to what was, he was saying about, you know, for profit. Well,
just give us your name for the record.
Rena Jones. I'm also from Concordia, so we're all very quite upset about what's happening in the neighborhood. But, you know, the comment about for profit, I think that it should, it's when it's morally wrong is when it's at the expense of everybody else in the neighborhood. What they're doing is going to devalue the property that we've all worked so hard to build over, you know, decades. There's people there that have been there for 50 years. It is a very established community. And so something like this, when it's done, you know, it should be, there should be some oversight. The other thing I have here is the permit. It's being pulled out on the old people's names. It's not even under the new people who bought the property. How is this legal? How is this possible that these people can get permits overnight? They came to my property personally and ripped off trees off of my private property and then just dumped them on my property. I actually tried to confront them, and I can't even get to the bottom of who's really responsible for this. Everett Custom Homes is on here, but the person who is the investor who bought the property is not accountable at this. It is according to the city, or if somebody from the future who comes back and needs to sue for the work that Everett does or this investor, they can't because this paperwork is off. We should also be able to file formal complaints against the builders for stuff like this. I mean, they just did a ton of damage, probably a couple $1,000s to my property in one day's worth of work. And, you know, I've had to put a lawyer on retainer now. This isn't right. We should be able to file formal complaints with specific builders because some of these builders are predatory. They're targeting specific neighborhoods. They're sending people in as private investors acting like, you know, real people and then, you know, turning it over to the builders. It's a very organized system, and these guys are fast, and they know how to work the loopholes. So I can't stress enough that you do need to change these laws immediately, because before we know it, we're going to see this all over Portland. These are 300 Doug fir trees that got put down recently in our neighborhood. They have targeted Concordia, and they are working fast to try to change it, and they're putting in cheap houses that devalue all the hard work that us we've put in as a community over several decades. And I also have 100 signatures from people within Concordia who do not want to see this happen, and they do not want to see that tree taken down. There's 100 signatures here gathered in just one weekend.
Thank you very much.
I'd like you to go ahead, actually.
My name is Veronica Schindrig. I live in, I didn't have a plan to speak, so it's probably kind of random. I live in the Division Clinton area. So I just have some sort of points I'd like to make. the developers, you know, ability, I think that's a problem, the developers' ability to remove houses from the historic inventory. But there's also an issue that neighborhoods that ultimately could be historic are not at this time. I've been in Portland my entire life. I remember when Irvington was not a good neighborhood. I grew up not far from there, so, and it was probably generally regarded as, you know, a let it go. The area I live in is actually, I have learned through my work, very heavily Italian, very, very heavily. Like, all the land was owned by a lot of Italian families, and some of them are still there. But, you know, the houses are probably not, oh, that's, you know, they're not the Google House or the Markham House or any ones like that. So, but I think there should be an opportunity to identify potential other areas that may become significant given time. I know there was a question about what kind of standards for whether you could remove a house, even if you have a delay. In my neighborhood, I can just, off the top of my head, think of two houses there was demolition permits, five where none were required, because they left a wall. And granted, at least one of those houses really needed to go. It looked like a mobile home from the 70s. And maybe that's a standard that could be applied. Is this house that we're going to tear down, does it even fit into the neighborhood anyway? That's just sort of a side thought. But the point on the demolition permits, it ignores the ones where they're not required. And in my neighborhood, there's a lot more where they're not being required, but the house is essentially gone. Completely, completely different houses going in. Then on the design question, we in our neighborhood, we now have a lot of four-story houses. They have basements that are at ground level. I recall in the 80s there was a big push to not allow what they call snout houses in Portland. These aren't a lot better. You're walking by a basement and a garage, and that's it. The houses are so much higher, and they tower over the surrounding houses. I also question, you know, the removal of all the trees. The Waverly Children's Home, they took out something like 35 trees and left three. And almost every one of these ones where they're adding, they're taking out all the trees to add. And I think that's a problem. Most of the houses in my neighborhood are not. There's a few that are dividing lots. But they're crammed right up next to a tiny little house and towering over it. Most of them are just putting huge and extremely expensive houses on existing lots. And my neighborhood is pretty much sort of blue. It was, you know, sort of blue-collar affordable housing, a lot of Reed students. All of that is disappearing, and it's disappearing fast. I have at least out of six neighbors that have been in our area for over 20 years, at least three of them plan to sell in the next year. So, and then the question of changing the zoning to extend split zones, because I'm so close to Division Clinton, I'm less than two blocks. To do that, my impression is like, oh, to allow the financial benefits to flow to the other neighbors, that's not the issue of the people I've talked to in the neighborhood. The issue is these huge buildings going up next to a single family house of a, you know, two stories or with maybe an attic, not a big living space. It's not, let's turn the whole block into, maybe a few people want to do that, into commercial properties, because that just brings the problem further down. The people are having problems with being crowded on their own properties and crowded out. So, and then, you know, the issue of parking should be treated but like a utility. The parking has very quickly become a horrible problem in my neighborhood, because we have all the restaurants. Now every night, it's two blocks up, you can't find a place to park. And I don't think requiring permits really solves that, because there's usually two-hour visitor zones. And the arguments that a lot of people bike, lots of people in my neighborhood do bike, but the people that are moving into these apartments, they have cars. And they're going to have cars, because they're not going to, you know, walk a mile in the pouring rain to go to the grocery store. It's just, or stand out in the pouring rain for the bus. So that is also kind of an issue.
Need you to wrap up, because you're going
yes.
On.
Oh, I'm sorry. The one thing that's kind of an aside is the developers, the whole issue about the street maintenance, the developers have destroyed the street, and maybe there should be some fees for that sort of thing. My last point is, some of this building is causing damage to existing houses. My house has developed major cracks in the plaster from all the construction nearby. So that's it.
All right, thank you.
All right.
Sarah, welcome.
Hey, my name is Sarah Hobbs. I live in the Alphabet District, and I am here today. In 1980, my father started the Architectural Historical Preservation Society in Saranac Lake, New York. So for 34 years of my 51 years of life, I have grown up seeing firsthand the importance of building preservation, including homes. and seeing firsthand how it plays a major role, not only into the history of the city, but as well the history of the state. Now, Saranac Lake, leveraging New York preservation tax credits and funding, they now have a $50 million hotel preservation project that is going on now that will bring money, a lot of money, into the, it's so small, it's called a village, when the ski season starts up next spring. So I've seen firsthand how this can work. And I see it as a very positive thing for the city of Portland. What I am here, though, very concerned about is the demolition issue with the loopholes and the other things that have been mentioned. And I would ask that you would adopt the 3 points that have been brought up extensively to address this issue. So that's all I really came to say. I've lived this through my father. I know it can be done. I was kind of surprised, please correct me if I'm wrong, to hear that the state does not have tax credits for preservation, or is it a funding? I may have heard it.
They once did, but I don't think they do now.
Yeah.
It's a designated building, too.
Well, yeah, because I know the Hotel Saranac preservation that's going to bring all that money into the village would not have happened if it were not for state preservation credits and funding, because it's a $50 million preservation restoration of a 110-room 1926 hotel. So I'm just here to say, let's make it happen. This is living proof that it can and it works. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The next three are Justin Wood, Claire Carter, and we're going to go with Judy Kafori. I'll take those.
And Mayor, before Carl calls the next three, after this three, I need what's fondly called a compassion break, since all there's right. only three of us.
A compassion break. Okay. Yes, indeed.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Let me do those.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Let's go ahead and go with...
Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take the compassion break.
Okay. Okay. Is there someone else that wants to come up?
Okay, come on up. We'll take you three, and then we'll break.
How many are left, Carla?
I think we're the last two.
Oh, okay.
I think we're it.
In that case, I can...
We need to be compassionate, though.
Oh, that's right. Kind.
But we should go fast, right?
She's got three more.
Okay. So, I can... Yeah.
We're going to have some discussion, too, so we might... Still take a break. Thank you. All right. Who'd like to go first?
Oh, thanks. Okay, my name is Claire Carter. I live at 6156 Southwest Nevada Court. I'm the current Maplewood Land Use Coordinator. I'm also one of two neighborhood representatives on the DRAC. My interest, and I have been on the DRAC for just a little bit more than a year, and it has certainly turned out to be an interesting time. My interest in being on the DRAC was to provide a stronger voice from the neighborhoods to the development community. And I have to say, in the time that I've been on the DRAC, I have been so impressed with the membership of the DRAC and with the responsiveness of city staff to issues that we have raised in our discussions. An example, and you've heard plenty about the demolition issue this evening, an example was we were on the demolition issue pretty early. As DRAC members, we raised this. Before the next DRAC meeting, BDS staff came up with a courtesy notification proposal. We had a subcommittee meeting before the next formal DRAC meeting to fine-tune it, and we're able to bring the door hanger proposal to the full DRAC and have it adopted with just a few tweaks within the space of 2 months. That's phenomenal for a community public process. That said, I think that... we have, great volunteers on the DRAC.
We are excited about the opportunity to advance solutions to the issues that we've been hearing about today. I would like to emphasize that we need to continue to strengthen the links of communication between the neighborhoods and the city. DRAC really wants to work on outreach and communicating and helping the neighborhoods understand both the land use and the development process so that we can together find solutions to some of these issues. And also, I would like to say in closing, you know, my kumbaya moment is that, you know, together we can protect what we really love about this fair city as we progress with optimism and the spirit of collaboration. And I'd like to really emphasize that, the spirit of collaboration, as we progress to face the many challenges of living in a city in the 21st century. It's only going to get more complicated. We all need to work together. Thank you.
Thanks, Claire. Thank you very much. Karen, welcome.
Hello. I'm trying to hurry.
It's all right.
My name is Karen Carlson, 1905 Northwest Northrop, Portland, Oregon. I'm here to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a story of saving the Goldsmith House. And I sort of talk about it, saving it at the speed of light, and as you heard Brian Emmerich say, at a ransom. The 1902 Goldsmith House is at the corner of 24th and Quimby. It's a majestic house, and it's quite a significant asset to our neighborhood. It just never occurred to anyone that they would demolish it. But since it sits on a 10,000-square-foot lot next to a 5,000-square-foot lot, both of which were for sale at the same time, you had the ability to tear down two houses and build seven. So I went back. I said speed of light. I went back and sort of looked at how this process worked for us. So day one, the NWDA Planning Committee, an architect came and told us about building these seven townhomes and tearing down these two houses. Well, we were quite alarmed, and on day two, we sent many, many emails to all of you. I'm sure you may remember. And a stop work order was placed. That was a Friday. We were relieved. The following week, we actually had a special meeting to meet with a developer asking why this house could not be saved. The following day, the developer was able to go down with the paperwork that he needed and ask for his demolition permit again, and he was placed on demolition delay. Again, we're happy. We're thinking 35 days, 120 days. We have time to work with him. The following week, had a couple more meetings with the developer, thought we were making progress. Day 15, the demo permit was released. So that's 2 weeks. We thought all was lost, but that was a Friday. Again, we like these Fridays. On Monday, the developer approached Dan Volkmer, who is Northwest Neighborhood's realtor, and asked to meet with Rick Michelson. So the next day, Rick and the developer met, and Rick asked, is there anything we can do to save this? What if we purchase the whole property from you? He said, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. He did. For $2.25 million, he'd sell the property to us. We had 24 hours to make a decision. Well, that's a lot of money to raise in a short period of time, but we called everybody we know, and by the 24 hours, we thought we can pull it together. So we agreed to buy the house, and on day 22, we inspected the house and deal was done. We had then 1 month to really raise the money, and we found 15, as I call them, angels. I tried to call them enablers before, but they kind of didn't like that word, who loaned us the money we needed to buy the house. Now, you know, it was at a ransom. I think we learned a couple of lessons, and that is, first of all, it's too easy to take a house off the inventory. This house was taken off the inventory, and a demolition permit was issued the next day. I'm kind of happy to say that it's almost harder to put it back on, but thanks to Tim Herron, we are putting the house back on the inventory. That's our first step to get it back to the national, to get it on the national register. And the other is that demo delay works. I mean, we only had 2 weeks, but it did slow things down enough to get the attention of the developer that they understood the neighborhood cared a lot. So demolition delay really needs to happen. And, you know, I'm happy to know it's going to happen for longer than the 14 days we had. Just so you know, we're returning the house to a single-family house. It's going to be beautiful. We're going to put it on the National Register. And we're also looking into the code preservation incentives to push a little more density on the rest of the property. And, you know, we're not against total every house demolition because we did demolish the other house.
With a delay?
Pardon?
With a delay?
No, actually. Well, only with the delight of we had squatters that we were having a difficult time keeping out of. We probably would have kind of held on to it a little bit longer. But we're hoping to then build development on the rest of the property because we're also not against development and add that subdensity. So I'm going to let Rick talk because I already took too much time.
Thank you very much for your work on that particular project.
I'm Rick Michelson, and I started my public service career dealing with demolition on a committee with Charlie in 1989. And here I am basically at the end of my career, or closer to the end of my career, dealing with the issue again. But I'm not going to talk about demolition today, although I have answered some of your questions. This is really a planning issue. And I was really happy to see both the Design Commission and the Landmarks Commission talking about how neighborhoods work and how they should be designed and developed in the future. I know those folks are overworked, but they're underused. You really need to have them involved in the comp plan process on a much more detailed basis, talking about neighborhoods, how they work, what kinds of development are appropriate or not. Maybe that'll double the number of meetings, but it means they could have some more fun and just not be a regulatory agency. The real reason we have this problem is that the city of Portland is grossly overzoned in some places and underzoned in others. Mm. We have, according to the vacant land inventory, we have the capacity to build twice as many houses as we need over the next 20 years on land that's considered vacant and buildable. Most of these demolitions that are taking place are not on those sites. These are extras. They don't even count towards that inventory. We could significantly reduce the number of zoning options and still meet our goals. The other problem is the problem with the 20-year planning horizon. If you provide enough density and opportunities for 20 years of development, you have no ability to steer what happens in the next 5 years. It's just sort of seems to happen randomly here, randomly there, suddenly there, without any sense of planning. I think we need to talk about how to make sure we're keeping our 20-year goals, but also working through them in stages rather than all at once and allowing anything to happen. The other thing that I think people don't understand is how much smaller the houses are in many of our neighborhoods, including our 1960s and 70s neighborhoods, than the zoning would allow. You look at the area west of Dosh Road that developed around the school there, those houses are probably using about a third of the zoning envelope that they'd be allowed. That's a huge difference. I think we need to look at that. We tried to simplify the code at one point so that all the side yard setbacks in all the zones are the same. I don't think that's necessarily appropriate or very workable. The other thing that I think we need to address during the comp plan process is not just talking about what's going to be built under the plan, but also what's going to be demolished and lost. So we can have the discussion that says to accomplish this 20,000 housing units, we're going to lose 10,000 units, or we're going to lose 2,000 units, or whatever the number is. So the public has both parts of that conversation. Mm-hmm. I really think that would be very helpful in beginning to talk about this. Commissioner Novick's question about the 120 days and whether it matters or not. In our particular case, if we'd had the full 120 days, we would have come to a different sort of compromise with the developer. Probably we would have ended up buying the house for a portion and supporting his development with extra density on his site. We didn't have that time. The other thing that 120 days does is allow developers like me who like to preserve houses to, when I see one of these, to approach the developer and say, hey, would you be willing to sell it to me? You know, I'll pay you what you paid and a little bit of profit, but I'm more interested in this kind of development. You're more interested in that kind of development. Why don't you go to a vacant site and I'll save that house? That can't happen in 15 or 35 days. I think the present system with a 35-day notice and the ability to then extend it if there's interest in saving the house is a very sensible way to do, and I think we could afford to apply it to all houses and not just the ones we're applying it to now.
Including the one with the squatter?
Excuse me?
Mm-hmm. Including the one with the squatters?
See, yes, including the ones with the squatters.
Okay, that's what I'm interested in. But then also to have some criteria for when you have the 120 days. It's
absolutely,
not just on demand.
And I like Jeff Fish's idea of the first piece being automatic, and then you can meet some criteria to do the others. In our case, in terms of the squatters, if the developer had known that there was a 120-day delay, they would have plywood over the windows and done some security measures that they didn't do, mm-hmm. thinking they were taking it down the next week. Mm-hmm. And that's what caused the problem.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much, and thanks for your extraordinary effort.
Mr. Michelson, I actually have a question for you and Mayor Hales, who are both on this committee that produced this report in 1989. And I noticed this report underestimated the population of Washington County in 2010 by 90,000 people, and underestimated the number of people in Multnomah County in 2010 by 105,000 people. It was almost dead on when it came to Clackamas County. It estimated, 367,000, and we had 375,000. So I want to know, who was it in that committee who was in charge of projecting Clackamas County's growth, and are they still alive? Because we hired them to work for BPS.
I believe those were Metro figures.
Numbers, yeah.
If I could just add one more thing about the market, one of the ways we could use the market to steer development where we wanted is by having a 120-day delay in those areas of the city where we're not really anxious to encourage development, but shorten it in the areas where we really are. So that would be another market incentive to too good. Thank you.
I'm going to take that brief break and come back for the last of the process. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
This is just fast.